subtitle might be James Dobson Revisited. I'd like to begin with asking, what are some of the qualities you would like to have your children develop, or that you wish children would develop? The characteristics, for instance, of when I was doing graduate work, one of my professors asked this of a course, and the first quality that came into my mind was that my daughters be sensitive, and everyone went, oh, they're going to be hurt so often. And I think of sensitive in a very different way, not that you're going to take everyone's words as being terrible, horrible, very bad, no good words, but that you're aware of other people's needs, concerned about other people and yourself. Okay, some qualities like that. What are some?
I would use the term caring.
Caring?
Okay. Nonviolent.
Nonviolent. All very good qualities.
Self-esteem.
That they have good self-esteem, mm-hmm. That the quality of feeling good about themselves is there. What else?
Honesty.
To be honest?
I may not like what you've done, but tell me the truth.
Okay. And often they don't, because they don't know what's going to happen if they do tell the truth. Okay. Some others.
That they may have a joyous attitude and awe of the world.
Yes. To have a joyous attitude, to be in awe of the world, to realize that this is a great gift. And that we ought to enjoy it without misusing it. Other qualities.
I missed the question.
Okay. The kinds of qualities we want children to develop, whether they're our own or other children, such as be nonviolent, caring, honest.
Respect for elders.
To be respectful, mm-hmm. Whether they're respectful.
That's true, of elders or
of all, even of their peers, of their siblings, of themselves. And I think we need to have respect for ourselves if we want, in order to be able to give it to someone else. Okay, so respect is a very important quality. Any other qualities that you'd want children to develop?
Independent judgment.
Independent judgment, that they aren't going to be moved by every whim and request of people around them. Okay, we can come up with a lot of other qualities, all of which can be very, very helpful and very important. Ones that someone may think of that we might not, and say, yeah, hey, that's a pretty good one. I'd like to go on with the independent thinking one, because in the subtitle of James Dobson Revisited, I think that's one of the qualities that is least encouraged with those particular programs. And unfortunately, because James Dobson does come out of a conservative fundamentalist Christian background, the label of Christian has gotten attached to his materials as if everyone, if you really want to be a Christian parent, that's what you ought to follow. I think the Lutheran view of the word Christian is that it ought to be used as a noun, only used as a noun, never used as an adjective. There are parents who are Christian. They may be good parents, they may be bad parents. There may be parents who are non-Christian who may be good parents or not so good parents. Shouldn't be using the terms good or bad. Helpful, not so helpful. But Christian parenting does not mean that it has a certain flavor to it. As Christians, we want to parent in ways that will help our children grow in their faith, in their development of themselves, in their concern for the world, and in belief in God and Jesus Christ as our Savior. That may not use the label of Christian parenting. So I'd like to propose that we may look at parenting that can be supportive, helpful, beneficial, teaching our children, helping our children to learn what might be in their best interest for the life that they are to live as Christians, the noun, and not use the term as an adjective. I think that's perhaps the Lutheran view of Christian, that we are Christians nouns, we are people who act. And because we have this background, we may do things that look, that model our faith, model our view of creation, and our view of forgiveness. So I have a variety of resources here. I list as part of the explanation that this would give some resources for family ministries within the congregation. I've been involved in family ministries in our churches and at a synod level, and recently in the last 5 years in Canada at a national level, as part of an overall family ministries group that's made up of people from the national offices. Unfortunately, our Lutheran Church in Canada does not have a national office with persons responsible for family ministries. The Anglicans, the United Church, the Presbyterians, the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, in Canada do. So we have an interdenominational mix that share of people from these various denominations who share resources. And we are looking really at the variety of resources that come with the name of Christian on them, and as a group feel very uncomfortable with the majority of them, and have come out with the response that we don't use the word Christian to give it a kind of approval or disapproval, but we look at what it actually proposes, how it goes about setting, understanding the responsibilities of child rearing, the responsibilities of being a parent, the responsibilities of being a partner in a marriage as Christians. Not looking at Christian marriage, but looking at being married as a Christian and how that influences our response. A few years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, I went to a two-day workshop that was held in Kitchener that was run by Tim and Beverly LaHaye, and there was just all sorts of public publicity about this event in our newspapers for weeks before, and I happened to see it, first of all, on a bulletin board in a Lutheran church that I was in for another reason. And I thought, I don't know much about this. And the title was How to Be Happy Though Married. I'm always a little bit concerned about the negative way around. And that it was promoted as Christian marriage enrichment. So that set off. And realizing it was an all Friday night, like from 6 until 10, and an all day Saturday from 8 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon at the auditorium of one of our community colleges. So I decided to go. I tried to get somebody else to go with me, and nobody was willing to put in that much time. So I went alone. My mother-in-law said, Kathy, why are you going? When you come back from that, you know you are going to be absolutely furious. She was right. I came back. Have any of you seen this marvelous little book by Judith Viorst that's called Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day?
No.
Well, it's marvelous. I learned about it when our kids were beyond the child stage, and I said to my sister-in-law, who had the youngest grandchild in the family, you know, one of the things I really miss about children growing up is that you don't keep in touch with all the new children's books that are out. She said, I didn't buy this for Margaret, I bought it for myself. So I bought one of the books for myself.
What's the name of it?
Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day.
Oh, yeah.
Delightful. That says lots of, it's been a very handy label to use. I came back from the Saturday event and I said, this has been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day for 3 or 4 reasons. And my mother-in-law said, who was a teacher and grew up in a pastor's family, a professor at seminary's family, married a pastor and raised 2 children who are now pastors. She said, what happened? I said, first of all, there were 1,500 people there. and half of them were below the age of 30. Second of all, I think I was the only one in the whole building that was alone. You know, families do come in various sizes and forms. You know, single-parent families as well as, well, they talked about how to be married, happy they'll marry, so that may have been part of the reason. The second part was, the third part was that they got into the issue of parenting, and Beverly LaHaye says, choose your weapons. Mm-hmm. And I listened for a moment. She said, none of this hand spanking. I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good. She said, but find your weapon. It can be the wooden spoon, it can be the wooden spatula, it can be a paddle, it can be a stick. But choose your weapon. The kids need to know that you have a weapon that you'll use. And that induces fear in them. And use it if you have to. Well, I, needless to say, sat back and breathed deeply but quietly. And then a little bit later, they allowed the writing of questions before the lunch break that they would answer afterwards. And I wrote a question saying, I'm sure you know the limitations of how you might use this weapon you refer to. But I work with a number of families where abuse is a real problem, and I'm wondering how you might further limit your comment about the use of this weapon, because it was just get a weapon and use it when you need it, so that we don't raise another generation of abused children. Could you share your experiences? It happened to be the first question she chose to answer. And her response was, I say, choose your weapon. I get my information about discipline from the Bible. And the Bible says, spare the rod and spoil the child, so I will choose my rod and I will use it. End of question response. Next question. Well, I talked about this with a social worker at our child family service afterwards. And she said, have you gone to the James Dobson series? I said, yes. And she said, I'm dismayed each time I see that program advertised in our community, the focus on a family, because I feel that too encourages abuse and choosing weapons and the issue of power. Let me come back to that. Let me go back to the next thing of Tim and Beverly LaHaye. She was leaving early that afternoon to go to Washington to meet with three lawyers that she had hired that were going to set up Christian Women, Alive or Christian Women, something or other, that's going to battle for the rights of Christian women. Tim LaHaye talked about a network that he had been responsible for setting up, which said that they have captains appointed in every city of over 50,000 population. So that if there was a particular issue that was of concern to the conservative fundamentalist church, that they could immediately transfer copy-ready materials on their position of that issue, that that person could distribute to all the churches in that area, and to ask them to do advocacy and letter writing and so forth, and said, if the government doesn't agree with us, meaning the conservative fundamentalist churches, we will twist them and tighten them and badger them to such a degree that they have to agree with us. This was completely off the issue of how to be happy though married. There were umpteen tables piled high with records, tapes, videos, books that the LaHayes, I don't know how they had enough time. I'm sure there must be a ghostwriter that does it for him, or he, he's a prolific writer. He has a programmed computer or something that he punches in some ideas and it comes out, because he must have had 20, 30 books that he's written on all areas of child development. But these are materials that in some sections of the country are the ones that are most available to our churches, because they have, quote, the Christian label on it. Back to James Dobson, who has a lot of materials also, Focus on the Family series, focus on marriage and partnership, a number of books out on discipline and how to break the will of the strong-willed child, and a few others. Dare to Discipline is one, How to Break the Will of the Strong-Willed Child is another, that I have some real concerns about. As an educator, both at the secondary, the primary, the secondary, the college, and the university level, I feel it's poor education. Where you sit and be, he's marvelous. He's a delightful person. And he's a charming person who's easy to listen to. He's a marvelous after-dinner speaker, the kind of person you'd like to listen to after a speech and a full stomach, and you want to just sit back and hear some jokes and stories, and that's fine. But as education, it doesn't involve the person. There's not exercises that give you a chance to try it out. There's no two-way communication that where you can ask questions. And it gives a philosophy that you follow this and everything will be right in the world and with your child.
Could you put the label of charismatic education on it?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, because he's a compelling, he is an enticing and intriguing person, and you could be very taken up by him, which is what I think charismatic. Am I correct in your definition? Mm-hmm. You follow him very quickly because he's dynamic.
And critically because you're being given the answers.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, yeah, sure. I had a, for a time, at the time I was dealing with some of these things, I was working as a program developer for Lutheran Life Insurance Society in Canada, which is the Canadian counterpart of Lutheran Brotherhood and AAL in the States, and you know the materials, the fraternal materials they produce. We were trying to do some of that on our smaller level in Canada, which was formed when AAL and LB decided Canada was too big, too few Lutherans, and they weren't making enough money. So they put all their assets together and helped to form a new company, but without all the resources that they had. So I was hired to do some program development, and I was looking at developing some things that would be helpful within the congregations on the family. And I was in a discussion with my vice president, and he had just recently seen the Dobson series. His wife is a teacher, he's a journalist, or a writer, and he said, we were talking about this, and he'd say, yeah, but it just sounds so easy. Why go through all these things? Parent effectiveness training, for instance, is a 24-hour series. It really ought to be how to talk. It ought to be called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, because it develops a communication system, and listen so kids will talk. Some real good resources and exercises and practice time in that program to learn to listen and to be able to reflect back, mirror back, check out that you understand what the other's saying when the other owns the problem. It deals with who owns the problem. And when the other person owns the problem, how we can listen. When I own the problem, how I can say it in words of an I message, where I take ownership of it rather than a put-down message of, you're such a stupid idiot, or can't you ever remember anything? Why are you always so slow, so late? Why'd you do that? Which are unanswerable questions, really, and put-downs. Nobody wants to answer them once they've heard them, because you've got to defend and protect yourself. And problem solving, as well as values collision. So, and he'd say, but you know, it's so much simpler. You sit down, you have 45 minutes of visualizing this movie, and then you can go home. And I said, how many of these things have you tried? And he said, well, there were a couple of things that my wife and I didn't agree on, because we have three daughters, very active ones, very involved, very energetic ones who range in age, I think at that time, from maybe 5 to 5, 8 and 11. But, you know, we set limits and we do some problem solving. I said, you've done some work with parent effect. Well, he said, I read leader effectiveness training. That's the same materials. Great. And it's usable. Basic principles, usable, whether it's with parent and child, child and child. I teach a program in the summertime for youth. I did one for ages 11, 12, 13-year-olds this past summer. Teaches those same basic skills of listening and talking, about feelings, being able to problem solve. You're capable. So the whole education principle, I think you go home thinking from a Dobson series, hey, yeah, there's some good things, and there are some good things, probably ones that you already knew beforehand because you experienced them, or you experienced the other side and decided, hey, that wasn't comfortable, I want to try something else. And so you may be tuned in. But I think on this, there's some not so helpful child rearing practices when it gets into the whole power issue. That with the issue of power, how many, I guess one of the things I completely forgot to put down there, there's a marvelous little 90-minute tape by Barbara Coloroso called Discipline. Barbara Coloroso. Discipline. Kids are worth it. And she's coming out with a new one this fall on teens. Barbara Coloroso, she's from Colorado. I have to think, in Canada we spell color with a U. I have to translate. One of the neat, some great things that comes out of hers, and I'm doing a workshop later this week on discipline, choice, or chance that will use a lot of her materials. Barbara Coloroso talks about parents coming up to her after a session and saying, my kid, she's just turned 12. She was a beautiful kid. And now can't do anything with her. I mean, she did everything we told her to do. She did everything we asked her to do. She studied the way we asked her to do it. Now she won't do anything. She won't study. She won't listen to us. She just is off with her peers. And Barbara says, I responded, you know, your child hasn't changed. She's grown up listening to an outside voice. She's still listening to an outside voice, only it doesn't happen to be yours. It happens to be her peers and the society out there. What we need to do is to teach our kids how to think, not just what to think. And that can start pretty early. To teach them at 3, people that come into my parent effectiveness training class, I use a tape that has a 3.5-year-old problem solving, dawdling in the morning with the mother. Marvelous! Mom comes up with all sorts of new information why the child is dawdling in the first place, which she had no idea about. Gives some problem solving, brings up some background, and brings up the needs that just demanding, ordering, threatening, warning don't do. What happens when we do that to kids and use the power play that I see Dobson in his Dare to Discipline and his Focus on the Family tapes encouraging, that you've got to be in charge. You've got to be that parent of that child. You ought to be in control. Well, that may work very well and for a while, but it teaches kids only what to think and then how not to be caught when they aren't thinking that way. And it doesn't teach them to develop that inner control. And now kids, by the time they're 3 and 4, they're off at play school, they're all playing down the street, they're doing other things, they're not under your arm, your eye all the time. And they need to know some limits. They need to know what's okay and what's not okay. And that's where teaching them how to think, not just ordering them, stop it, don't do that, don't touch. I often am asked by parents in my groups when I talk about modifying the environment. That means if you've got a below 3-year-old or below 4-year-old or maybe even below 5-year-old, you house-proof your house. You put away the breakable things, put out the things that are you're willing to have the kids experiment with. If you have a playpen, playpens are marvelous things for parents to sit in if they want to get away from the child. But I don't think they're very helpful for children for more than a second or so at a time when you have to turn your back and you're not sure what's going to happen with them. When I was doing my doctoral work at Syracuse University, there were a couple of things I wanted to do my research in. We moved too often, too far away, so I never really finished it. But I would like to have done a long time study on infants raised in homes that used playpens and the philosophy of leave everything out and teach them not to touch. So that when you take them to grandma's house, they'll be nicely docile behaving children. Versus those where the house is childproof to the extent that they can basically do a lot of experimenting, checking out the world, exploring, being creative within limits. That there's paper for crayons. Crayons may be used at the kitchen table. The crayons aren't to be used on the wallpaper or the paints on your bedspread. You know, that nursery schools do that all the time and get, you know, do well. The painting corner's over here. And when the child begins to wander away with the paintbrush in the hand, the teacher comes up and says, I guess you've decided to not paint any longer. Child says, you have a choice. You may paint over here in the painting corner, or you can leave the brush there and find something else to do. It's your choice. Teaching kids how to make decisions within limits. Not allowing them to put the paint over every place. That's not, a lot of people feel that if you aren't in complete control of your child, then pandemonium and chaos exist because that means you're permissive and you'll let them do anything. There's a lot of space in between those two extremes. And I suggest that as Christian parents, as parents who are Christians, operating within our framework of our Christian faith, that having qualities that we want to encourage for our children, such as independence, separation from the family. If you've been in any of Peter Stanky's sessions, you're well aware of the need for separateness, that you are you and I am me. I often have parents do a holding on of hand. Let's do it right now. Just hold hands of the person next to you. I'll try this hand for a while and then this one. Just hold hand. Hold hands with the person next to you. And try to determine where your hand ends and the other person's begins. Are you sure where that is? Wiggle around, feel so that you know what's yours and what's the other person's. Everyone know where your hand ends and the other one begins? Positive? Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Recognize that with your child too, where you end and your child begins. You are not attached any longer. Women were for 9 months thereabouts, but you're not any longer. Cahil Gibran says, you cannot possess your child. The children may be of you, but you may not possess them. I don't have the full words on that. That children have their thoughts, their ideas that we cannot possess. They may hear our thoughts, our ideas, but they may not make them their own. They may. That's a choice that they have. But that's not automatic because they're our child that they are going to have do everything in the same way that we want them to do it. So the whole issue of power as a simplistic discipline means I think limits our children. And that I think children who are told, no, no, don't touch that, don't, 900,000 times a day, are going to feel the world is not a very good place to be. I'm not a very good person to be in this not very good world, because I can't do anything right. They're discouraged rather than encouraged, and they give up. And then we get children into kindergarten, first grade, second grade, or wherever that grade, wherever it hits them, and they sort of give up. I can't do it. It never works out. Why bother trying? It's not going to be any good. Kids that now say, why should I learn history? Will it earn me extra money in my paycheck? I only learn what I have to learn, only do what somebody else tells me I have to do. Well, I think as people who have been given the gift of creation by our Creator, it's an exciting world out there. We have responsibilities, yes. But there are lots of things that have been created. At one of my classes last week, I read a little article, which I don't have here now, for all people born before 1945, all the things that have come into being since then, including the ballpoint pen, watches that operate on a little battery instead of the wind-up kind of thing. Person on the moon. Jet. Yeah, the kinds of jets that we use now in comparison to what they had in then. Anyway, those things are created by people who say, gee, there's another possibility. What can we do that might be of benefit to this world? Not all the things that are created are of benefit, however, and sometimes we know it beforehand, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we think, well, it'll make us some money. And they create it anyway. But I think that's one of the limitations of the issue of power, that we do what will benefit us in the short run or the long run, rather than what might be beneficial to not only me, but other people as well. And I think as a parent who's a Christian, my responsibilities to our two daughters were to help them to develop some of these qualities we mentioned earlier, that they feel okay about themselves, that they can be creative and venturous, that they can learn things, and if they make a mistake, we can learn from it. You can't learn less. You can process what went wrong and figure out what not to do another time so it won't happen again. That even the greatest inventors didn't invent their creation the first time they tried. Edison took 1,400 tries before he got the workable light bulb. And some people said to him, wasn't it discouraging? Why didn't you stop 1,400 failures? And he said they weren't 1,400 failures. It was a 1,400-step process. I learned something with each step along the way that helped me improve it for the next. So to help our children learn how to think, that choices, and we have forgiveness from our Creator. I mean, that's the gift of the Christian Church. That we may not always do the thing correctly the first time, or respond to our neighbor in a helpful, caring, kind, supportive way, but we can make amends. We can ask forgiveness of our neighbor and of our God. One of the other things I'm concerned just in the whole philosophy behind some of Dobson's, and then I'd like to give you some other choices. In the very first film, he talks, and his mother and his wife are in the audience, huge, massive audience. And the camera focuses on them on a couple of occasions, and he talks about learning all he's learned about discipline from his mother when he was a young child. And he said, back in those days, women wore corsets that had these long garters that hooked up the stockings. Pantyhose weren't invented before then either. And he said one time he disobeyed his mother, and his mother's response was to pick up this corset that was sitting on a chair and just fling it over at him, and these garters enwrapped him like a boomerang or a rope would enwrap you. And he said, I decided at that point I would never disobey her again. I had fear for her. I didn't want that to happen again. And so all I've learned, she showed me she had power. You know, those weren't exactly his words. Those are my translated words. And I beg your forgiveness, James Dobson, if I have misinterpreted that. That's how it came through to me. Fear. I'm not sure I want my children to be afraid of me. I'm not sure the fear Dobson used in that sense is what Luther means in his explanation to many of the commandments on fear, love, and trust in God above all things. That fear is a different in awe, standing in awe and in reverence. But the fear that we use nowadays is not the fear that Luther used in his day. Fear is mainly afraid. Be frightened of them. Be careful because they can do you in, kind of thing. I'm not sure I want my child to be afraid of me. I want my child to respect me, because I can show respect to my child as being a worthwhile human being, a creature created by our God. And God doesn't make junk. I like that little button. Have you seen that? God doesn't make junk. He doesn't. We may junk some of the things that he's created. And he may permit us to make some junk and let us decide whether this is really something that's going to be helpful or beneficial for our world and whether we really want to put it into the world. He gives us some choice. We have some free will. But I want my child to learn from me without being frightened. I don't think I ever learned anything from a teacher in school at whatever level, elementary, secondary, undergraduate or graduate level, because I was afraid of something. I learned it best because the person was compelling, motivating, enticing, and saying, you know, here's some possibilities. Look them over, decide, make some decisions, explore. Not the things I did the worst in, and I got a D in one of my early education classes because it was this, 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 this. I got an A in my student teaching. I did it well. But I, you know, those memorizing dates, memorizing names, you know, the only one way of doing kinds of things. In my day, that education class was not taught by a very creative teacher. Also, about 500 people in the class. And
so what is different between that and any other education course, I'd like to know?
Well, education courses, perhaps.
Of course, I'm talking about the dark ages, that isn't fair. Really.
Yeah, to let people experience some possibilities and saying, okay, we did in-town student teaching, we did out-of-town student teaching. You might check out with your supervising teacher or to watch when you did observations. Watch what worked and what turned kids off and what turned kids on.
We didn't even have such things. So, yeah. Like I say,
it's improving gradually along the way. Yeah.
It's wonderful to see how it has evolved.
I've done a lot more parent classes in schools this past spring, so I would walk past long halls of elementary classrooms with the doors open, and I was really quite excited about the kind of learning that was going on. The rooms were exciting. There are lots of different, visually exciting, visually interesting, colorful, creative, and a lot of different things going on with kids, not sitting as we did and hearing, you know, everybody sitting with your pencil on your desk and the paper in front of you, taking down every word that the teacher said.
I had an interesting experience in Oklahoma when I taught second and third grade. I was taken aside by some teachers who used the paddle. They wanted me to join them because the teachers were definitely divided. People who didn't use the paddle and the people who did. And it was interesting to note that the ones who didn't had better discipline than the ones who did.
There was respect that went both ways, from the teacher to the child and the child to the teacher. I'm an okay person. I taught 7th, 8th, and 9th grade home ec for a while. And when I first went into that school, and it was a school that was a very integrated school, a lot of bused-in black children in Syracuse, New York. A lot of old country working population, and where kids would say, if my father ever knew I did this, he'd kill me. And she said, I'm not kidding, my brother, and then they tell the horrible, the abuse that was going on in the family, some of those families. So it was a difficult situation. And my vice principal said, if you have difficulty, send the kids down. So the first couple of weeks I sent down a troublemaker or two. And then one time during a free period, I went down to check on something other, and the vice principal said, Kathy, I have one of your students who's been sent down by another teacher from another class in my office, and I need a witness. Would you come in? I had no idea what he meant. Okay. So I walked into the classroom, and he said, whenever I paddle a student, I need a teacher witness. My mouth fell, and I stood back against the wall, watched this vice principal tell the kid to get everything out of his back pockets, lean against the wall, bend over, and gave him 5 swags. Do you know what one of these fraternity paddles are like from university days? about an inch thick and about that long. And he picked it up and went like whap, whap, 5 times. I vowed I would never send a child down to the principal's office since then.
We were each given one of those paddles in our desk drawer.
And I tried to work more with the kids and say, you know, here's some responsibilities. What can we do about this? I think that worked out much better. Yes.
Maybe the opposite side of that, too, is a child has to be guided and know how to use freedom. And many times the very strict discipline that is absolutely lost in a free situation, and they're usually the worst. Mm-hmm. I taught art. And my first experiences were kind of because this
you
was
were
the first
all over
where the kids came in and absolutely were allowed to be themselves, were allowed to be free, and they couldn't handle it. And of course, what the rod really means in the 23rd Psalm is guidance. Mm-hmm. Be my guide and comforter. And I don't know why rod isn't translated that way in other places in the Bible. And
yeah.
See, that's where they're so off when they use the rod. But I thought, well, it's this knowing how to be guided. And we know we have generations of people that don't know what to do with their free time, their free selves, because they have not made decisions themselves.
Yeah, Stephen Glenn has a new book out called Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World, 7 Building Blocks for Developing Capable Young People. I have his name on the board here, too, as having a tape set out. I think there's six audio tapes, each 90 minutes, and a leader's guide that's available for about $45, and a little booklet that I think is available for about $3 each, that looks at not a point of rehabilitation, but a lot. We can't rehabilitate some kids because they've never been, quote, habilitated. They don't know what the limits are in a social situation, and we have to start at that basic ground level first. And I think one of our goals is to raise self-reliant children who feel that I'm okay because God doesn't make junk. I am a forgiven, created child of God. I am loved by God and by others. Not everyone, but there are some people who will love.
What's her name?
This is Stephen Glenn. And it's the one down here from Humosphere in Hearst, Texas.
My question is, what kind of limits do you set here? You need, children have to be taught or helped to think on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But as a parent, you still have to set limits.
Yeah.
And every event that happens in the day, you can't sit down and discuss it, especially when you've got younger children. As a parent, don't you have to say, these are the rules and these are why, but we're going to go.
How old are the children, for instance?
5 and 8.
5 and 8. They go to school or will go to school, have gone to nursery school? 5-year-old? Okay. Will go to school. 5-year-olds, as I said, you can start teaching problem solving to 3.5-year-olds and to say, we have a problem. How are we going to solve this? What can we do differently? Children who are participants in setting the limits will be more likely to follow them than ones that say, now do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, and they say, you make me. A 2-year-old can exert, an 18-month-old, 2-year-old can exert a lot of will and a lot of power. I mean, that's the developing of themselves, of the self. Because whenever they close their mouths, we're not going to eat, you really can't force them. You can put it in their mouth and they can spit it back out. So that's more often is a battle of wills than it is anything else. And we need to allow them to have some other, if we're saying no, 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 no constantly to them, then this is one way they can say no back to us. They don't have very many other ways they can say it back to us. The potty and food are a couple of them. And you can sit them on the potty for a couple of hours, they won't do anything, you move them off finally in disgust, despair, chastising them, spanking, whatever, and they'll pee in their pants and 3 minutes later to say, you can't control. Well, I think there are ways that we can, I've given the illustration of we need to recognize how much, what's the balance in our goodwill bank? And what ways are we affirming them so that when we have to say no to a response, that they're willing to listen to it, because generally we've got a good thing going between us. I don't have my copy of How to Talk So Kids Will Listen. The bookstore is out of them. The library doesn't even have one. This is a book written by the authors Faber and Maeslisch a few years earlier. One of the sections in How to Talk So Kids Will Listen is on the chapter Encouraging Autonomy, the Development of That Inner Self, section on alternatives to no. Some of them might be yes when. Yes, you can have a cookie when you've finished your meal. Yes, I'll read a book to you when I finish washing dishes. Instead of saying, no, I can't read a book to you now. Quit bothering me. Stop. I think children under two and a half, your basic discipline methods, and we'll get more into that later this week, although you may not be here, diversion, distraction, removal, modifying the environment. I don't think children learn anything from a pat on the behind or a slap on the hand other than mom's mad at me. And we might find a different way to get across the information. One of my parents who'd been in...
Can I beg to differ on that point? Can I interrupt or is this a good time? My son at four has a little sister. Mm-hmm. I think everybody knows him. She has big cheeks.
Mm-hmm.
He would go up and pinch her cheeks. And we tried everything from no meals, taking away favorite toys, quiet time. Saying, why do you do this? How are we going to stop it? In frustration, and that's what a lot of spanking is sheer frustration. I said, next time I see you do that, you get one spank. The next time, two spanks. Next time, three. So he did it. The next day, he got a spank. Did it 3 days later. I saw him, he probably did it in between that I didn't see him, and that's fine. I don't care about those times.
But he said, see, there are times I can get away with it.
Yeah, when I don't see him, but when I saw him, he got the spanks. We got up to six spanks. 6 months ago, we got to seven spanks. We never got to that point. We haven't gotten to that point yet.
You know, what probably really happened, if you want a viewpoint of it, is that he decided there's another game he can play. He's not going to play the pinching cheeks game. That's worn itself out. It doesn't get the response from you that it originally gotten, and so he'll try another game.
I don't know that game yet.
Yeah.
I mean, he's probably doing something, but I just don't know it yet.
There might have been other... And what probably happens, I bet there have been dozens of people up at the village, probably including my husband, who's gone up to your daughter and squeezed her cheeks.
Pinched her cheeks, yeah.
Yeah, because cheeks are just so pinchable. And if bigger people can do it, why can't littler ones? We live in Chalet 7 with Gertrude Lundholm, and Gertrude's daughter and son-in-law. Gertrude's daughter is married to a Swede and lives in Sweden now and has two dear, delightful little children. We were talking the other night about Sweden's national law that prohibits spanking. I mean, there is a sentence or a fine for parents if they spank their child, if they're seen spanking their child, or somebody can report them.
There are laws now here. I think our state legislature.
Well, good for it.
Minnesota.
Yeah, and I said, you know, what's the basis of that law? And the basis basically is that there are other ways. If we don't have the choice of spanking, we learn other more humane, helpful, beneficial ways that can build and grow, that can help develop that inner control that says, this is not helpful.
What do you do in that case?
What in that case, each time he started to head toward the little sister, I'd turn him away. If he's four, when it's happened, I'd...
He's quicker than I am.
Yeah, and he knows that gets you.
Sure.
And one of the things...
And another, by the way, I haven't had to spank him since on anything.
Yeah. One of the things one of my parents, who's been in a couple of classes of mine, said, you know, I finally put together some of your words, and what I think you're really trying to tell us is that kids' brains aren't down here, they're up here. That, you know, when we spank kids, we think this is where their brains
are. But that didn't answer the question, though.
What would I do? I would, three and a half, starting at three and a half, I'd say, Johnny, we have a problem. It hurts when you squeeze so-and-so's cheeks. But you probably see other people do it, and they do it in a different way. And somehow you're saying, if they can't do it, why can't I do it? And that's a good question. Maybe we need to tell them not to squeeze her cheeks too. But what can you do? Maybe he's really doing it half the time to get her attention, half the time to get your attention. Is there another way that we can do it? And each time I see you do it, I'll just have to put you in timeout. And that's take. And for a young child who's social, that's.
Timeout's brutal.
And 2 minutes, they say, or 4 minutes, a minute for each year of age, for average, if it's a real serious thing, 2 minutes for each year of age. None of this 2 hours, 45 minutes. I mean,
attention.
10 minutes away is a lifetime for a kid who's 4 or 5. Their time concept is very different from ours.
I have a question about timeout. Timeouts work wonderfully with my daughter, except when I'm in a spot where I can't have a timeout, like
in somebody else's home, in a store.
Or, no, someone else's home. We can usually find, like in a store or just in a public place where you can't remove her from
a restaurant.
Yeah, what you can do in the beginning is to say we're going into the store now. If we need to use a timeout, we'll walk back out to this corner. We'll leave our groceries. Walk back out. You may even walk back out to the car and sit in the car for the timeout. Let the child sit in the car, you stand up, if it's decent weather, you stand outside the car. I wouldn't leave the child alone. I'd be there, but I'd not be quite close, you know, to interact with the child. This is quiet time. And I like the idea that the newer title for use of timeout as renewal time. Fours can begin to think, you know, what can I do differently next time? Is there another way that I can ask for it that's acceptable and helpful rather than unacceptable to learn the difference? That give them a chance to think, that give them some choices. We have a choice, you know. We have a choice when you want, you have some choices. When you want to get Mary's attention, you can. What can you do? And a 3-4-year-old can come up with some ideas. I can tap her on the shoulder. I can tickle her under the chin. I can call her name. I can, you know, whatever. Let them come up with these ideas. Most often when we ask them to help us in problem solving or brainstorming some ideas, they'll say, I don't know. And they may not know because for so long we've been doing the thinking for them. All they have to do is wait a couple of minutes and you'll fill in the blanks. And what we need to do is wait out long enough. Let's say, well, let's think about it for a while. Maybe we need some renewal time, just some quiet time to think. I don't want to talk in terms of punishment. I want to talk in terms of teaching. Because the role of the word discipline refers to the word disciple, which means a learner. And we want to help our children be learners of more socially acceptable, positive ways of managing their life in society. That they're okay, the world is okay. And God has created both good.
Another thing that I thought of when you gave this example of some of that is sibling rivalry. And I think any of us who had more than one child have seen the older child, you know, loving the younger one to death. You know, there's some affection, but there's also, And I think some interpreting of that and saying, I'm sure sometimes you feel like life just isn't the same anymore now that we've got the new baby in the house.
Great.
And but you have to know that she's not going to go away. We love you both, and we're going to have to find some time, just you and me. But I cannot permit you to be mean to her or squeeze that hard or
okay.
Whatever.
I cannot permit you to be mean to her, squeeze her cheeks.
Maybe the language was...
And he does it. How does one get one child's attention when really every other method has been tried? And that the timeouts, taking away the toys, and I mean, and they're still away. I mean, he hasn't gotten them back. I mean,
then
the attention has to be gotten.
He's not doing it to your daughter, he's doing it to you.
He got my attention, but I did, yeah. I got his.
Yeah, but it's a game. He's still saying, I still have some power. I'm not going to show you that I'm missing these toys. He's probably got enough other ones there anyway. The book, one of the things that comes to my mind, when Julie says this, and thanks for bringing it up, I thought of it and then got off the track. Faber and Maislisch also write a marvelous book called Siblings Without Rivalry. And one of the techniques they use in there when one sibling is hurting another is that you give attention to the hurt person, not the aggressor. And you may say, as you pick up little Mary, that must hurt. I'm sure Johnny means to try to get your attention or to show you some love, but it hurts anyway, and that's not any fun. You say something that doesn't necessarily put down the child, but gives him an information about what's happened. And when Mary gets the attention and not Johnny, then the game is over. You know, I've not gotten the attention that I really wanted. And to be able to come back to Johnny at another time and when there's no problem and to say, you know, sometimes we do have a problem with the way you deal with Mary, and I'm wondering how else, if you want to get my attention, how can you tell me directly rather than doing it through Mary? And stop the game. Most often, the games continue because it's unwritten rules and it's unspoken description, so they'll try to get around it. It's a couple of other things, and then we can let's see. In the bookstore, I think Jean Ilsley Clark's materials are outstanding. She has one on self-esteem, a family affair. And this is another one that's growing up again, parenting ourselves, parenting our children, and it's looking at affirmations, looking at ages and stages, looking at nurture, structure, and dealing with children, and what kind of affirmations, what kind of encouragement do children need at these certain ages, for whatever stage of development they're going through. And even if your child has passed this is fine, because we always recycle. Even though, if we've gone through them fairly well the first time around, it'll be easier the next time, whether it's in teenage or latency age or adult age. We do it again and again as adults. The easier we've gotten through it the first time, the easier it'll be the second time. If we didn't manage to get through it the first time, that's okay, we always have second chances. Second tries. And there's some, it's really outstanding. There's a whole section in here, let me find it, of little faces with affirmations in them to cut out. I didn't mark it and now I can't find it. That are really very helpful for different ages, for the different needs of the child at that time, that you can duplicate and color and, you know, do whatever way to remind yourself. I think that's very helpful. And if you want to do something within a family ministries group in the church, to go through this, have one person just, you know, somebody just give some ideas out to talk about how do you develop your self-esteem.
What's Jean Ilsley, the other book?
Self-Esteem, A Family Affair. They're both in the bookstore. David Augsburger has come out with a number of them. Caring Enough to Confront, Caring Enough to Hear, Caring Enough to Forgive, that are also very helpful and very, very beneficial. Bradshaw and the Family has a set of videotapes out, and I saw the two tapes on the shelf by the coffee urn in the dining hall Sunday night. Left a note saying, whoever they are, you know, I'd like to know how you got them and could I see them. They were gone by Saturday night, they were gone by Sunday morning, and I haven't heard from the person. But it was a program that he did for PBS television. One is called Bradshaw on the Family, and I have that down, John Bradshaw on the Family, and also 8 Stages of Man. I don't know why anyone still uses that word and limits all, you know, the other 80% of us in this group. But the book also, looking at what we develop from our family of origin. You know, Peter Stone, who's been the village philosopher, this is his father. His father and mother have done a long-term study on youth, and they did 5 cries of youth, looking at loneliness, family trouble, outrage, closed minds, and joy. Later they wrote an interesting book also that's called 5 Cries of Parents. That one's in the bookstore. to go through, to bring, pull out some things that might be helpful. There's a whole variety, there's racks and book stories on the early child. Toddler Taming is a captivating title that looks at a variety of things that go on in those toddler years. But there's a variety of others. You can get materials from your public health nurse, too, that are free, that are very helpful.
Are there any books other than Dobson's that would address the very strong will child? Anything that you would recommend?
Strong will child?
Is that an extreme strong will child?
I think basically the strong will child is because they are having so much power used against them. Your power, their power is probably a little less. There is one.
Can I share something on that? A different perspective than what was done here as far as strong little children are concerned.
Uh-huh.
I found, well, my daughter, who's now 8, was this way, and my son is growing up this way, that quite often if they have capabilities and skills and talents that are beyond their years, for instance, the child might already be a sculptor, mm-hmm. but just hasn't been provided with the tools, that will and that creative energy is going to be expressed in other ways, some of them destructive, because first, they don't know that. Once they're praised of it, it can become a game. Is that a very strong-willed child, at least in my case, is the person that you start growing more in front of. You know, and
giving more opportunities to.
More opportunities. If we're digging boulders out of the yard, well, then you find some smaller rocks. Say, you roll this. And really allow them to really push their capabilities and take that energy and focus it into work.
The only problem with that is when you can't do that. I mean, there are times when it just seems like there isn't enough challenge to throw at a child.
You might, one book that I realize I don't have here is called Perfect Parenting and Other Myths. And there's some sections in there. It uses Dreiker's philosophy, which looks at what's the basic goal of the child in this behavior and gives a lot of illustrations that deal with problems, particularly strong will, in a positive way. And it's by Frank Main, M-A-I-N. It's out of Minneapolis. I found it in a used bookstore, but it's like 87. It's fairly new. And it looks at blowing the cover on the game. Now, I'm wondering if we're having problems with this because, would you like to hear my ideas? Yeah. Well, I wonder if you're doing it because. And how can we meet your need in a more acceptable way to do some problem solving with it? And to set rules and limits together, to give as much encouragement and affirmation as possible, even for the things that you normally take really for granted, so that you build up that goodwill bank and then find ways to channel that energy into positive experiences.
I think that's what a child won't talk to them. I've been talking like that with my daughter since she was born, and she's this age now. I'm not ready to talk about this. I don't want to talk about this. We talk too much.
Yeah, she's using power on you, saying, okay, I'm not going to listen, and I'm not even going to talk to you, because when I do, I have to give up some of my power. And we have to say, you know, I really wonder if the reason why you're not wanting to talk and not wanting to listen is that that means you have to give up doing some things and to have some limits. And, you know, there are some limits that I have, too, that I may not want to, but because I don't want to keep driving down the street and not look at any stop sign, just go as fast as I want to. But that may not be healthy for me or for another driver, that we do have to identify some limits. What are some limits that we can work on? And do some problem solving with it. That perfect parenting and other myths, I think, would be very helpful for it, that particular concern. Don't think we want to break the will. If you want to do some visualizing and think of them in terms of a teenager, there's good and bad news. To say the strong will can say to the peer pressure, no, I don't really want to go out and booze tonight. Or I don't want to go out and get high. To have enough courage to say no in the situations where, for a lot of teens, it's very difficult because they don't feel very good and don't have the strongness of will.